The following episode of Bookmark was first broadcast March 18th, 2025. Every day, every day, every day, every day I write the book. Chapter 1, you didn't really get along. Chapter 2, I think I fell in love. All right, good afternoon and welcome to Bookmarked on KZSM, where today... The book under discussion is Deep Roots, Broken Branches, a History and Memoir by Victoria Bynum. And my guest, I'm happy to welcome Victoria Bynum, her own self. You might say hello or something.
Hello, and thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, I'm very glad to have you. Vicki is a historian specializing in the Southern United States. She's Distinguished Professor Emeritus of History at Texas State. Her book, The Free State of Jones, on the Civil War history of Jones County, Mississippi, inspired the 2016 film of the same name. And I wasn't going to say it, but I have to say it, starring Matthew McConaughey.
That's just fine.
She's also the author of Unruly Women, The Politics of Social and Sexual Control in the Old South, and The Long Shadow of the Civil War, Southern Dissent and Its Legacies. And I usually start by trying to summarize the book, so I'll give it a shot, and you can always correct me.
Okay.
As I said, the subtitle is A History and Memoir, and it's a history of Vicki's family starting back before the Civil War, but it's also the history of the country. And reading this book kind of made me think about how the history of every American family is sort of a history of the country in a way. If you start thinking about what economic and cultural forces, wars, things like that, that impinge on the family, I mean, we tend to think of, oh, my family is unlike any other family and we do our own thing, but really you are kind of a product of these forces, and it's that interaction that you bring out so well in here. Vicki's grandmother and her story really inspired the book and form its center. Her name was Mary Daniel. She was the daughter of an affluent, successful Minnesota family who in 1918 rebelled against her privileged existence to marry a German-American Catholic from a farm family. For the rest of her life, Mary Daniel, Vicki's grandmother, struggled to continue reading, writing, and drawing while maintaining a difficult marriage and subsequent generations of an often troubled family. Anything to add?
That pretty much sums it up.
Okay.
I would just add that you are absolutely right that we're all a part of the larger history, and it shapes us. And I learned that so much just by researching this book. I learned much more than I had ever known before about them, and I thought I knew a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How did you come to write this?
Well, the fact that my grandmother left me her unpublished memoir when I was in my middle 20s, but I didn't know what to do with it. She had never published it. She had given up on publishing it, but she wanted me to have it because of my interest in her history. I had come across some letters of the family at one point and was really interested in that. They were Civil War letters. So that's how it started, and I was originally, as I began to go to college and get a college education, which I did late in life, at least my late 20s, if that's late in life, mm-hmm. but I was going to at least annotate it, and then I more and more decided as I became a historian myself that I would like to look at it in a broader fashion. The decision to make it a dual memoir and a history much broader mm-hmm. than I would have if I had just covered her life. That came later. That actually came only within the final few years of putting it together when I thought, I'm going to put my own memories with this. Because one of the reasons was that as I got to a certain point in my grandmother's memoir, I knew a lot more than what she had known. And mm-hmm. I started wanting to put in my experiences because it would broaden what she was saying about her own younger generation. And so that's how it came to be where I decided we'd do this together, she and I, even though she was no longer alive.
Yeah, and that's very much how it feels. How long did it take to do the whole thing? I mean, I guess you could say it started, as you talk about in the preface, when you're 24 years old and you get this manuscript of her memoirs. But you know, how long once you kind of started working on it?
Yes, seriously working on it, because when I was a young woman, I would do things like put together scrapbooks, and I put together a big genealogical table and sent it to all the others in the family, and was really proud of that. But to really start this book, I would say that that began seriously in really just before the pandemic. I did a lot of the writing of this during our recent pandemic. But I had already begun to write up my own memories in a way that was much more casual. I mean, I didn't think that I was going to actually go and submit my own memoir to a press. I was thinking about self-publishing. And so I had these chapters kind of put away that I had been just writing about experiences that it was just important to me to write about. I had a story in me that I wanted to write.
Yeah.
And so there they were, and as I began to seriously work on writing my grandmother's history, and researching her history and writing it around the memoir she had left, then I came to a point where I really felt the need to combine them. Mm-hmm. And that was quite a leap.
Yeah.
It was scary.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure how to do it. Should I start with me first and then all of a sudden go to my grandmother? And to a certain extent, I did. But basically, I kept it chronological and really just changed my approach to it. Mm-hmm. Fairly dramatically.
Yeah. So it's not an academic book. Did you find a different? Let's see. It is published by, I might should have mentioned it, the University Press of Mississippi. So it is an academic book, but it's not the traditional academic book.
Yes.
It's part of a series called the Willie Morris Books in Memoir and Biography. Well, it certainly fits that. You know.
Yes. I don't consider it an academic book of the sort that I have written in the past. It's like the Free State of Jones was a little bit of a transition from straight academic work to beginning to do this kind of work. But in this, I think probably the most difficult part of writing it, the most challenging part for me, and an editor helped me with that very much, was trying to find a voice that really fit this. I couldn't give up my historian's voice. I used it, but I tried to always return to my own voice as quickly as I could.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in the second half of the book, that was, of course, much easier because that's where I really got into my part of the memoir and was writing about people that I knew intimately.
Right. Yeah, it's fascinating. Some of what you write about is pretty personal, both about you and about your mother and your father. And so we have adultery, alcoholism, family violence. How did you feel about sharing those rather delicate things?
Well, at times I did take a deep breath as I decided to, yes, I'm going to tell these stories. I felt that they were really important to understanding the whole evolution of the family, not just as it began with my parents, but really once I began writing the history before them, you know, my grandmother's history, their childhoods, then bringing my father's history into it as well, I realized that all of these things were really connected. And I also felt that they added a very important element to understanding what I really learned about both my grandmother and my mother and myself as I wrote. A thread of continuity in perhaps the frustrations and the sort of anger that I see in all three of us that was handled differently by all three of us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think looking at the personal things like the abuse in my family that children all suffer under in an alcoholic family. It was my father who was the violent alcoholic. The things that we went through there, I felt, helped me to understand the meaning of what shame and guilt are, and to work that backwards and try to realize, how did that affect my mother? What was it in her childhood, looking at her Depression-era childhood? And my grandmother, her alienation from her own family. And trying to trace that thread became very important to me. And I felt that if I was going to, you know, really look intimately at their childhoods and their young adulthoods, I needed to look at mine as well, even though it was not always easy. Yeah. By any stretch.
Well, I admire your fortitude. I want to pick up on something you said, because I haven't mentioned yet that this is National Women's History Month, and this is certainly a very appropriate discussion to be having about this. But you talked about a thread of anger sort of connecting your grandmother, your mother, and yourself. And I don't know, there's a feminist spin to that or something? Would you?
Yes, most definitely. I think, in a certain sense, we all three generations suffered unhappy. For me, first marriages. Mine was a first marriage. Neither my mother nor my grandmother were ever married more than once. They stuck through their unhappy marriages all their lives. So there was that, and there was just the sense. For my mother, the economic sense that she could not leave her marriage, that was the biggest problem. My father's emotional dependence on her, but also her lack of economic independence. Yeah. For my grandmother, it was more religion. My grandmother became a devout Catholic. To her, I never even saw any sense that she thought about leaving her marriage, but she certainly wrote openly about her misery within it. For me, I'm the generation that was able to break from that. But I think where my similar sort of a kind of an anger that runs through the family came more from probably the violence in the family that I experienced. I don't think either my mother or grandmother grew up in a violent family. They grew up repressed by just the choices that they either felt forced to make or felt they couldn't get out of once they made them.
Feeling forced to make choices.
Yes.
That's certainly part of the women's experience, and it's not so much as completely in the past as we might like it to be.
I agree.
reading this book, I thought about getting married kind of as the only way of finding a different life for yourself.
And that was certainly the case for my grandmother. Her choice of and her reasons for getting married, and she didn't get married that young. She was 30.
Yeah.
But she wanted a different life. She wanted a different identity. And I feel that very strongly after writing the book, is that she was really in search of an identity, very much a part of her Catholic conversion.
Yeah. Oh, well, we'll have to go into that some more. What would you like your readers to get out of this book?
I think the complications of life, how they do relate to the world around us. I think each and every one of us, my grandmother, my mother, and I, all experienced certain aspects of society that were unique to their generation. For my grandmother, you know, this Gilded Age and then World War I and the Depression, going right into World War II. And so for my mother, it overlaps, but then it's the 1950s. The world of the 1950s, which promised so much, but really delivered so little in terms of opportunity to specifically women. And for me, there were many more choices, but they were not always as liberating or as good a choices as we'd like to think. So what I really hope people will get out of it in reading it is just a sense of, first of all, part of my looking at some of the uncomfortable personal things, the personal abuse that I experienced, is looking honestly at yourself, looking honestly at what things you felt ashamed of, how did they affect you in making life choices, how did they hold you back? Because I think there's a lot of that in this book in all three generations. And so if someone can sort of see themselves in this and see the limits that whatever the cause of your repression or your guilt or your shame is, that there are ways, hopefully, that you can find to work your way out of it. I feel that I'm the generation that was able to do that, frankly.
That's wonderful. And certainly, you know, you mentioned seeing your own history in terms of of larger events, and it reminded me, I mean, I'd thought about this before, but that I felt like my mother was traumatized by the Depression and also by some things that she never wanted to talk about, but I felt like they were, I mean, being poor and the wife of a musician in 1930s West Texas could not have been entirely pleasant.
No, it must not have been.
So it made me reflect, you know, on my own life, which I appreciated. So thank you.
Well, I'm glad that it had that effect, because that's certainly, when I write about my mother, that's certainly a lot of what I put together in writing about her, the Depression era. My mother had a lot of bitterness from the mm-hmm. Depression era that made her resent her own mother in ways that I think I explained in the book. More than her father, she resented her mother. And the way in which she dealt with her marriage was something that I learned piecemeal over the years. Mm-hmm. She would tell me things. Usually she would have a few drinks, and then she would tell me things. And that's where I learned many of the secrets of how she survived her life, how she built a secret life for herself.
Yeah. You, in your preface, you describe yourself as inspired by your grandmother's papers, and we've already kind of talked about that, you know, and you get this memoir when you're a 24-year-old high school dropout with two small children. But you are kind of always like that, and this is... I didn't warn you, but you might even remember that I do like to read some passages from the work to give people a sense of what it's like. And certainly, here you are 10 years old, and you and your family have recently moved to California and have rented a farmhouse. And you're kind of liking that. You're liking the opportunity to be outside, and stray animals found us. You say you have a dog and you have a cat and kittens in the shed, and you know, and you're really sort of enjoying this. But here, one day while feeding the cats, I discovered a yellowed stack of newspapers on the shelves of the shed. The front page, dated 1948, which is probably like 10 years before,
yes,
or something like that, featured actress Ida Lupino showing off her legs under the guise of modeling high heels. She was much younger than the actress I recognized from TV. Reading these dusty old newspapers was almost as interesting as viewing Mom and Dad's old photograph albums. My fascination with the past, with the lives of movie stars, had only just begun. So, where do you think this fascination with the past has been with you for a long time? Where does that come from?
Well, I've thought about that, and when I added that in there, it was because it still strikes me as a little odd, too, mm-hmm. at 10 years old, that why was I so fascinated? The fact that they were such yellowed old newspapers was the initial fascination, and then just seeing someone in an earlier period of time that I hadn't known about. I think much of it comes from I had a kind of an insatiable curiosity about how people became the way they were and why they did the things that they did. At a certain point in that same chapter, I think I discuss reading the Child's World books, these mm-hmm. volumes written for children when I was young. And I was just always, I became fascinated with the history of things mm-hmm. at this young age. And then because of the household situation I lived in, I think one of the most unique readings that I did was when I, one day, since there really weren't any more chapters to read in the books, I read The Mother's Guide in the end. Mm-hmm. And The Mother's Guide was meant for parents, you know, mm-hmm. and it was a kind of a child-rearing guide, and I got so much out of it. So many questions I had about my parents, you know, their child rearing, the things that happened in the household. And I think that is a big part also of my always wanting to, you know, I was a voracious reader and always wanting to know the reason for things, mm-hmm. why they happened. And yeah. I'm still that way. I mean, and I started off liking movie magazine gossip. Mm-hmm. And I used to laugh when I was a historian because I knew this all started with reading movie magazines.
You know.
And I also thought it was very interesting and unique that my book, The Free State of Jones, actually got made into a movie. I thought, oh, my God, the 10 to 12-year-old me would have just loved this.
Yeah, but, got to be in the movie, too.
But never would have imagined it, you know, because it was just a need to know, you know, a drive to know at a young age.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you talked about reading the parents' guide, and you reminded me of finding a child-rearing book from, I guess it was the 30s or the 40s, that evidently had belonged to my mother, so must have been, and being kind of horrified with some of the child-rearing practices. I don't know. Is that, when you say you learned, did you learn like why your mother treated you the way she did, or how your mother should have treated you even though she didn't, or?
Well, I found it kind of comforting because the things that my parents didn't do, for example, one of the points I make in there is that I was a bedwetter. Mm-hmm. And in there they actually had a nice, comforting description of how parents should act. And it brought me comfort because I thought, the people who wrote this book know that I don't wet the bed on purpose. Mm-hmm. I was so tired as a child to hear people say, why do you just lay in bed and pee the bed? You know, and you know, you could never get anybody to really believe you, you know, after the fact. And there it was, all in a guidebook, someone saying, children don't wet the bed because they're lazy. It's usually, you know, physical sort of late maturity type thing, or it can be emotional. But whatever the case, I was comforted by it for the most part. But I did notice things that my parents didn't do, and I didn't really blame. I mean, I didn't really think it was so bad until I read it was bad in the book. Yeah. like a mother standing behind a door while her child answers the door, and she's instructed them to tell them that their mother's not home because it's somebody they don't want to see. No. I think I may have done that myself as a parent a few times.
Yeah. All right. Well, I warned you, and we are now up on our first break.
Bookmarked is brought to you in part by the Whitliff Collections at Texas State University. San Antonio has inspired generations of writers, musicians, and artists. Now, the city's creative currents are highlighted in a new exhibition at the Whitliff Collections. Spirit of San Antonio, drawn from the Whitliff's vast archival holdings, explores the city through many of its leading creative talents, including writers Sandra Cisneros, Rick Riordan, Carmen Tafoya, Naomi Shihab Nye, and many more. Also featured in the exhibition are selections from the extraordinary Ramon Hernandez Tejano Music Collection at the Whitliff, which includes treasured photographs and recordings from Tejano legends Selena, Flaco Jimenez, Sonny Ozuna, Steve Jordan, and more. Rounding out the exhibition are captivating images from celebrated photographers and artists weaving an unforgettable group portrait of this fascinating American city. On display now at the Whitliff Collections at Texas State University. For more information, please visit thewhitliffcollections.txstate.edu.
My name is Mason Moore, and you can catch me and my rescue pup, Franklin, every Wednesday at 10 p.m. We're bringing you any significant event from the past week, album releases, song releases, birthdays, deaths, cultural events, nothing is off limits. We're spanning over 80 years of music history on the weekly show, all genres welcome. Find your next favorite song right next to your old one right here on KZSM, True Community Radio.
All right, welcome back to Bookmarked, where today we are talking about Deep Roots, Broken Branches, A History and Memoir by Victoria Bynum, with Victoria Bynum. And we've kind of talked about the whole process of writing this book and looking at your own past in the context of the generations of your family, but also in the cultural and economic forces that are impinging on that family. So your mother's side of the family's history starts in Wales, and you say it looks like you researched some things about Welsh settlers, and I don't know, or maybe you already knew those things.
No, I did quite a bit of research, reading mainly in secondary sources.
Yeah, one of the interesting things I thought was was that the Welsh tended to be against slavery, but tolerant of, you know, the dispossession of native peoples, you know. The promise that the America's vast frontier would end the Welsh nightmare of displacement predisposed them and other immigrants to assume that the dispossession of native peoples was inevitable. Oh, now that I read that sentence, I'm even more fascinated by that. And then you say the Welsh, their immigrants, their overall acceptance of native dispossession contradicted their widespread opposition to black slavery. But so the Welsh nightmare of displacement predisposed them and other immigrants to assume that the dispossession of native peoples was inevitable. Wow. Would you expand on that a little
well,
bit?
Well, I see that in generally in terms of their own self-interest. Mm-hmm. They were coming to America for land. They wanted desperately to believe that that land was empty and just waiting for them, but of course it wasn't. No. And I think in its place, they bought into the very popular excuses given by the government itself for the dispossession of Indians from their lands, and that's that they were a primitive people, that they did not put the land to good use, that they would be better off on reservations, they would be cared for there. The typical kind of paternalistic rhetoric combined with violent dispossession. And as I mentioned in the book a little further on, not all Welsh stuck with that view. There were some who later, you know, expressed their sympathies, who recognized what had happened. But in general, immigrants were land-hungry people, and the displacement of Indians was to their advantage. And I think it's the insights just into how human beings can go to tremendous lengths to justify what they're doing, imperialism. In regard to slavery, however, the reason I make the contrast there is that the Welsh themselves had very much experienced the imperialism of Great Britain, and a lot of their displacement was on account of that and on account of slavery, exactly what the institution of slavery was doing to the British economic system in terms of what they were taking in order to, well, to make slave shackles, to make so-called Negro cloth. All of this was changing the lives of Welsh common people, people who worked in factories and in mines. And much of their migration to America was to get away from the world that was being recreated by British capitalism and imperialism. So there's an interesting, a real contradiction there. I mean, it's a definite contradiction, but somehow they
worked it out.
But it's
rooted in their experience.
It's rooted in their experience and also in their desires.
Yeah, and you explain that very well. So in the late 1800s, the Daniel family achieves really successful middle-class prosperity in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, later in Minneapolis and Kenwood. Kenwood is also in Minnesota, right?
It's a suburb, basically.
Yeah, okay. I tried to
Minneapolis.
Tried to look it up, and it's one of those things. It's a suburb now, but it was another community then, I guess, right?
You know, I'm not really sure exactly of the whole origins. I've always seen it as a suburb.
But there's a lot about, you know, they're building a house there and all that. And then you have, Lou Daniel, who is your great uncle. I'm going to need help on some.
Yes, he would be my great uncle.
Okay. Oh, good. I got that one right. I need help on, you know, the basic line I have, but some of the
people. I understand. Believe me.
Did you decide against a family chart in the beginning, or did your editors not want one? Or
I did not. I decided against it, and it's interesting because I had charts in two of my academic books. Mm-hmm. But my reason basically was that I did not want this to be taken as a family genealogy. Mm-hmm. I was a little bit nervous about that, and presses oftentimes don't like genealogy tables for that reason, unless it is strictly that kind of a study. So I It would be useful to have one, let me put it that
way.
Well,
if you don't mind that I and probably other readers are going to go, wait a minute, who's Lou? You know, Lou is your great uncle, and here's his picture looking about 15 or so.
Yeah.
This is 1887, and they're in Oshkosh, and he's in high school, and they have a pretty comfortable middle class existence, this family.
Yes. So
he delivers an oration on the Negro problem at his high school commencement. In the speech, Lou advocated education in working class trades, echoing the conservative white progressive approach to racial uplift popular between 1880 and 1914. Rather than integrate African Americans into public life with full rights of citizenship, Lou advocated training black men for jobs that would provide them with incentives to abandon their slothful ways, a view typical of the Northern philanthropist courted by Booker T. Washington during that era. But Washington believed that the limited goodwill displayed by moneyed white men offered the best approach to combat the violent segregation and economic exploitation that blacks suffered in the New South. Do you think that their privilege, Lou's relatively privileged position and that of his family, sort of shaped that kind of patronizing attitude?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Lou, I think, had no real understanding of what black lives were like, certainly not in the South or the North. And I think that, he had grown up with a class privilege that his father, for example, who fought as an abolitionist in the Civil War, had not. And it's just interesting to see that in just one generation you see this development of a lack of a class consciousness of just being of the upper class. And he was very typical of his times, very typical of that emerging Gilded Age attitude.
If I remember, Washington thought that economic success was a first step towards full equality, didn't he?
He did. He saw this as a ladder. He saw ladders of advancement. And, of course, that didn't happen. But that's what he envisioned, Whether or not white middle-class people like Lou and possibly his parents saw it that way is another question. But I think that in a sense, they did. They thought that they had to be raised up like children or something before they could really enjoy their freedom.
Get over those slothful ways.
Yes.
The family also gained status through marriages, and you talk about that, how a couple of her older sisters marry these prominent, successful men, including one, the wonderfully named Bingley Fales, who belongs in a novel,
I thought it was the same thing, Bingley Russell Fales.
But Bingley Fales gives you an opportunity to sort of indict or talk about the changing Republican Party, which after all was the party of Lincoln. It was, as we even today continue to remind ourselves, and the opinions expressed on this broadcast are those of the host and guest only, and not those of KZSM or its parent corporation, SMTX-CRA. You have this paragraph. Bingley insisted, he's talking about the Spanish-American War, employing popular imperialistic jingoism, Bingley insisted that liberating Cuba and the Philippines from Spain echoed the American Revolution, which had liberated his forebears from England. What? Okay. 2 years later, however, while serving as Detroit's assistant prosecuting attorney and secretary of the Michigan League of Republican Clubs, Bingley spoke before the Frederick Douglass League and belittled the Filipino guerrillas fighting for their country's independence as not animated by anything approaching the American colonist spirit of 76. In the wake of the Spanish-American War, the United States revealed its more modern spirit by occupying the Philippines and annexing Cuba. And in heralding the Republican Party's shift away from racial justice and towards imperialistic ventures on behalf of big business, Bingley dishonored the black abolitionist for whom the League was named. That's powerful stuff. Again, is it because of economic success which then distances people from those they might have helped or might identify with? Is another case of that?
I think definitely it distanced them. I mean, Bingley came from a Republican family, a rural Republican family that probably truly was the representative of the party of Lincoln. And yet, by this period of time, you know, the late 19th century and early 20th century, where he's very much an imperialist and in view and not at all worried about the little people. I mean, I love this statement he made once that I quote in there, where he bragged about stiffing a waiter who had too surly an attitude toward him. I mean, he has definitely become part of the Gilded Age upper class, noblesse oblige at best, but a hypocritical attitude about liberation, certainly.
Of yeah. Okay. Finally, the central focus, which is Mary Daniel. And Mary is lonely and frequently angry from childhood and alienated from kind of her fashionable, much older siblings. I just mentioned her two sisters who marry these, you know, successful up-and-coming men. Why do you think she was always so different?
Well, I think the circumstances of her birth are an important part of it. You know, the fact that her mother died giving birth to her. I've never really thought about survivor's guilt being applied to a child who was born to a mother who died giving birth. But I think Mary had a tremendous amount of guilt over her birth being the cause mm-hmm. of her mother's death. Mm-hmm. And the fact that she was 10 years younger than her next in line sibling, they were much older than her, I think made her feel a distant part of the family.
Yeah.
And those two things are the earliest examples of that. Other than that, I wish that I had known people that knew my grandmother when she was a child. Mm-hmm. I only have my grandmother's words, and it would have been interesting to hear them talk about particular aspects of her character. I mm-hmm. mean, there's certainly, by the time she's a young woman and begins dating my grandfather, there's certainly an element of liking the role of the martyr. And some of her, I think, attraction to the Catholic religion and the anger that it caused, particularly, she says, from her sister Marge, I think my grandmother was really relishing the role of a little bit of victimhood there mm-hmm. and martyrdom. Mm-hmm. And she probably started developing that in childhood, this sort of feeling that the family left her out of events. Well, I think one of the reasons they left her out is she was so much younger.
Yeah.
But she resented it and took it personally. And I think that goes back to the feeling that they resented her because she killed their mother.
Yeah, I can see that. And interesting, she had a good relationship with her stepmother, actually.
This is what's... And both her parents, really, she had what seemed to be, from her own descriptions, just wonderful father and stepmother. Mm-hmm. And that is kind of a... You know, she never says a bad thing about either of them. And yet, mm-hmm. there's always this sense of alienation. But it's mm-hmm. more directed at her siblings.
Right.
And some of her aunts and uncles. She's pretty rough on them in her memoir.
Yeah.
So... It doesn't really answer the question, but it kind of takes the heat off of her parents and puts it elsewhere.
Okay, and here comes, I guess because we were thinking of the 50s, I want to say here's the $64,000 question, which is why she marries this guy. I think I want to talk about him and then talk about the marriage, because I love this. His name is William Bernard Huckenpöhler. But he calls himself Bill Harrigan after the 1908 song by George M. Cohan. And I'm probably the only reader of this book, or maybe not, who's going to get a Harrigan earworm about reading this. Because I was there were sort of Irish stereotype songs that were popular in the 50s when I was a kid, and my dad liked them, you know, like... Clancy Lowered the Boom, and maybe Before Your Time, and The Same Old Shillelagh My Father Brought from Ireland, and one of these, even though it was an old song from 1908, so that's my Harrigan earworm. But so why does this? And apparently, this guy had a German accent to the end of his life.
Oh
right?
Yes,
yeah. My name is Bill Harrigan. I'm trying to imagine that in a German accent.
And my grandmother must not have known what an Irish accent was versus a German one, since she just assumed he was Irish because his name was Harrigan.
Yeah. Why did he do that, do you think?
I've tried to figure that out. I've suggested perhaps during the period, around World War One, but then again, he lived in a town where everybody knew the family was German. Mm-hmm. My mother told me that he just loved the Irish. He had an Irish girlfriend on the side, Marge O'Reilly. He used to sing and dance. He had this, my mother could imitate it, where he would clap his hand and tap his foot and sing mm-hmm. the song, mm-hmm. Harrigan, the George M. Cohan song. So where that came from, I wish I would have asked my grandfather, but I really don't know.
And he lived to be 97 or something like
yes,
that.
96, yes, 96, almost 97.
So, Mary, she has one very unsatisfactory teaching job, but then she has one that she likes, and she has a social life. She makes friends with some women who are intellectual, like she is, who she can really talk to and enjoy. She's in Waconia, and really, as you say, she describes herself as footloose and fancy free in 1913. She goes to dances, she skates with friends, she organizes school events. Earlier on, you talk about a couple of women relatives of hers who are new women, which is what she's becoming now, and she talks about...
her college experience exposed her.
Daisy had everything, this is that was denied to Mary Daniel, an independent life, fulfilled by the pursuit of creative and personal interest. Mary claimed that she lacked the genius to follow this path, but it seems more likely that wealth and elite education, self-confidence, and perhaps sexual orientation guided Daisy toward choices in which marriage had no place. But, why did she wind up marrying Harrigan and not fulfilling this new woman promise?
Well, she did not like the Ullman family that Daisy came from. That's an interesting part of it. Mm-hmm. I felt that she was fascinated with the life that Daisy carved out for herself. Daisy never married and, really had the life of an intellectual. We went to women's history women's conferences back in the 20s. But I don't think that the idea that Mary had that she wasn't smart enough, not genius enough, and all of that was just her own excuse. I think that she resented the Ullman family. She already, as a young woman, by the time she went to college, for some reason had an aversion to the greater wealth. Remember, the Ullmans were much richer than mm-hmm. the Daniels, than her mm-hmm. family. You're getting your family of lawyers and senators and, state senators and that sort of thing. And I think her resentment of the wealth there, and perhaps her inability to, again, confront her siblings. In a certain part of the book, she explains in her memoir how her siblings got together and had a family meeting. Her father was dead by then, mm-hmm. and they decided that she could not do any of the things she wanted to do, that she would not be able to be an artist. She couldn't study art as a profession. She could not go to work outside the home in any certain way as a salesperson. That's too much like a servant. The only appropriate job for a lady, and this again is why this book is really about women, the only appropriate job for her would be in teaching. And she had a brother-in-law who was an artist mm-hmm. who and a writer and did all of these things, and nobody thought that that was out of line for him. But for her, that was considered just improper. And what it was they wanted her to fit into their proper scheme of things, at least mm-hmm. according to Mary. Mm-hmm. And so I think we can look to that as an important part of it. But beyond that, it's, I think, Mary's own resentment and alienation sometimes worked against her own interests. Mm-hmm. If she could have somehow had that resentment and yet taken advantage of what was available for her, maybe rebelled then against her family instead of later through marriage, but she didn't do that.
Mm. Yeah, and apparently lived to regret it. And then there's we don't know much about what drew her to him. And of course, I guess by the time she starts writing, things are not going well, so mostly she's talking about what's wrong with him rather than, he had gentle, courteous ways, you say. Even his slight stutter endeared her, and apparently other women, to him. He was equally enamored of her. In addition to loving Harrigan, Mary enjoyed the fact that the Daniel family thought he was unsuitable for her and deliberately wore her engagement ring to dinner at Kenwood. The whole family took turns telling me how wrong it was, arguing that he just wouldn't fit into the family circle. But I had never fit into the family circle myself, so I couldn't feel the force of that argument.
There's that part, but I do think also she was attracted to him. He was a ladies' man. I mean, there are old newspaper articles. He's always sitting with women. He didn't marry until he was in his 40s, or maybe it was his 30s. I'm trying to think. I'm not sure exactly how old. He was a good deal older than her, and she was 30 when they married. Yeah. So he's about a decade older than her. But I think he must have had a certain charm. He loved to dance. He was, he was not really a religious person. It's really interesting that she, a religious convert who was later called by her children a fanatic, would marry a man who really didn't take the church all that seriously, even though he was born to it.
Yeah. Would you? I just realized we have talked past another break, so I'm gonna take a really quick break, and then I want you to tell me about why she became a Catholic.
Okay.
You know, and as you say, she said she became a Catholic because of him, but he certainly didn't seem to care whether she was a Catholic or not, you know,
right.
So far as I could tell.
Yeah.
So, all right, we'll be right back.
What could drive a woman to murder? Find out Thursday, March 20th, 3 p.m. at the Price Center, where we'll honor Women's History Month with a live reading of Susan Gluspell's provocative short play, Trifles, followed by a question and answer session on the experiences of women in the justice system. Today and in 1916 when the play was first performed. Join us to find out what really happened that night.
All right, and I hope you will join us to find out what really happened that night. But right now, we are in talking with Dr. Victoria Bynum about her history and memoir, Deep Roots and Broken Branches, and about a lot of it focuses on your grandmother who... kind of inexplicably, not only converted to Catholicism because she married a Catholic who didn't care whether she was a Catholic or not, but stuck with it all of her life and expressed great concern when her children got divorced because the church didn't sanction divorce and was really very devout. And it seems, why was that? Or do you know?
Well, She was attracted to my grandfather. I do think it was a love relationship there, but a very important part of it was also the rebellion that it gave her against her family. The fact that it really got into, you know, was a thorn in their side. They were horrified by the fact that she was going to marry this Catholic farmer's son. I don't think, even though he never took the Catholic vows that seriously, he would have had a lot of trouble with his community and his parents had he married a non-Catholic woman. So there was still an element of that being an important segue to their marriage. But it was definitely more important to her than it was to him. Yeah. And I think that the conversion to Catholicism, at one point, you'll notice in there that in her memoir, she makes it clear that she was so taken by the Catholic Church that she decided to become a Catholic even if they didn't get married, because their relationship was off and on for a while there. And she was going to become a Catholic nevertheless. I think Catholicism gave my grandmother an identity that she was seeking. It in the Catholicism that she found in small-town Waconia, it also connected her to small-town life, which she had romanticized for a long time. She was just fascinated by one of her friends' lives, you know, life in the country. She spent a whole page in her memoir describing going home with her and making ice cream with them all day. I think my grandmother just yearned for this kind of image or even a myth of what life would be like in a small town. And my grandfather offered all of that to her. And so I think that becoming a Catholic was kind of revenge against her parents, but more importantly, a really strong sense of identity, something that she seemed to lack at that point in her life.
Yeah. Yeah, you suggested that. And I was wondering maybe when I read about it that it gave her a sense of a purpose, you know, that she was serving a higher ideal than her family, whom she tended to think were shallow and materialistic.
Oh, exactly.
You know,
that was an extremely important part of it.
You know, so, you know, she says they had a what does she call it, a grab bag or a grab fest for a Christmas celebration, and nobody said the name of Jesus.
A big grab bag of gifts.
Yeah. Harrigan always works, but works hard, but their lives are disrupted a lot by the need to find work and keep work. And remember, we're looking at kind of in the 20s and 30s here, and they often have to live apart. You say that months of misery that she blamed, and she now blamed their German working class culture for her predicament. I think we're into the 30s by now. In truth, the fault lay with marriage, motherhood, and the predatory post-war economy.
We're really back in the early 20s here, and I'm talking about like World War I there, and then moving into the 1920s. Yeah, my grandmother, you know, this romantic view she had of small town life was pretty much crushed early into her marriage when she had to live with her parents because she did not want to live in Duluth, Minnesota.
With her in-laws, you mean? Yeah.
Yes, with her mother-in-law, her mother and father-in-law, because they had briefly tried to find a place to live in Duluth when he was working there. He would work for a company there, manual labor and that sort of thing, and it was a very rough life for them in the post-World War I period. So the solution was to send her back to live with his parents. So there she was living in small-town Waconia with his parents, pregnant, without her husband for a good deal of the time except for visits. And she had become a Catholic, but when she went to church with them, the services were all in German. She couldn't even understand them. And she pretty quickly became disenchanted and then, as I said, in there, began to use words like this, you know, this damn Dutch, this mm-hmm. and that, and she didn't use the word damn, not yet then, later in life, but she began, you can see it coming through there, that she's resentful of the whole German culture, and in fact, it was, as you can pretty much see pretty clearly, it was her marriage that had put her on this track. She was quite happy in Waconia when she was a single school teacher, playing circle games with students on the street. Mm-hmm. But she married into this family and into this culture and into an economic way of life that was nothing like what she had grown up with. And mm-hmm. she didn't have the skills for that working class life that she had entered into. She'd try to help his mother, but she really couldn't cook.
Yeah, you talk about even later on, she was not a really great housekeeper.
No, she never liked
housekeeping. She was still trying to read and write and draw, and, you know, her kids were sometimes embarrassed by her housekeeping.
My mother in particular, I heard that from my mother all her life, and that was a lot of her resentment of her mother, was that she felt, see, my mother grew up in this German community where it seemed to her like all of the housewives and mothers around her kept clean houses and had wonderful food cooking and all of that, and she would have to run home and get all the dirty clothes out of the way or the clean clothes off the couch and just make her place presentable to her friends. So my mother, you know, she resented my grandmother, and she really sort of thought that the education was what made her the way she was. She wasn't good for anything useful. to my mother as a child, embarrassed by her.
Yeah, I've got more questions than I have time for here. But here's one: your grandmother and grandfather struggle economically. As I say, even though he is a hard worker and always works, but he has trouble finding work. He will lose jobs. He'll be laid off. They'll have to move, and this goes on. On the other hand, your father, Stan Bynum, was in the military, which seems to give your parents' lives and yours growing up relatively more economic security. I mean, things would go bad for your family because your father drank too much, but then he'd just get posted somewhere else and then start over, you know, and you'd be okay for a while. And, you know, so is that, and you even talk about World War II as kind of what brought your parents together and how they even look back almost fondly at that period of their lives. So the military makes a big difference.
It certainly does, and it's hard. It's hard to think that World War II could be the most wonderful memory, a halcyon period of time for my parents, that it was. But it was because they were young. My mother was 17 years old when she met him. He was 24, and the military gave them economic security. Not right away. They were quite poor during a certain period of time when my dad, after World War II, got out of the military and tried to become a salesman of all things, something I can't even imagine. He didn't even own a car. But he quickly made his peace with the military and went back in. And it was the military in the 1950s was a way in which an alcoholic could keep their job. I mean, I saw that firsthand. Oh, they would get rid of his drunk driving tickets. My dad, if he was really hungover, could go out for so-called roll call, just sign in, and then come home and sleep on the couch. And it's something that I deeply resented as a child. It made me ashamed of my father. But it's one of the biggest reasons why my mother stayed in the marriage was because the economic security was pretty, even it wasn't a lot of money, but it was enough to keep us lower middle class. And she was a child of the Depression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We've only got 5 minutes left. Anything you particular? I've got some favorites, like the books that influenced you and things like that. But anything in particular you would like listeners to know about this book?
Well, no, go ahead and go with your questions.
Okay. You talk about yourself as a child. You read Lillian Roth's I'll Cry Tomorrow, which is a memoir of an alcoholic. You read Peyton Place, which is about adultery and even family violence and abuse and things like that, as a child. And you like reading them because they depict situations like the ones that you were facing yourself. Is that partly why you became a historian?
I suppose so, although I didn't know it at the time, and I certainly never articulated anything like that to myself. I think that, again, they brought me knowledge. They were part of my quest to always understand. Mm-hmm. I wanted to understand human nature at a very, very early age because it was in my interest to understand it. Things were so chaotic around me. It wasn't just my family. It was, you know, my mother's family. Her older sister was very much a part of our lives, and she was an alcoholic as well. And so there was a great deal of chaos in my life that made books like that, they helped me to understand the situation I was in. Mm-hmm. And I knew that I did not want to live that kind of a life. And gradually, of course, you know, became a historian. But at first, I wanted to be an artist, and later, literature was my first major, or second major after art.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't realize that you. Do you still draw? I didn't realize you wanted to be an artist.
Yeah, I still do. Oh, yes, yeah. Oh.
All right. So, are you kind of preserving your? I do want to note that your grandmother started this round robin letter, which would circulate among her children and keep them in touch with each other. And I thought it was interesting that the ideal of taking care of family that she had kind of assimilated from that culture that she married into sort of melded with her desire to write, and so then she's kind of putting those two things together. I don't know, that's the way I saw it anyway.
Yeah, I think so. I think, for example, in the 1920s, her keeping a diary in which she recorded every mundane thing she did, literally every hour, you know, I swept the floors, I did this, it's terribly boring for any ordinary person to read, and yet it kept her writing, it kept her, you know, it kept her mind off of the housework that she hated to write about it instead. And the round robin, I think, did really serve an important outlet for her. It kept her writing to her. She was just an incredible letter writer, which is part of why I was able to do so much with her history all the way to the end of her life, because she wrote letters till the end of her life, whereas the family history only takes us to 1940, the memoir, and then the last part of it is just notes. So, yes, I think very much that was a part of her continuing to want to be an intellectual, which writing was the lifeblood of her intellect, and also, though, the other most important thing in her life is keeping her family together. Yes, she had sacrificed so much for that, and so the letters really serve that purpose as well.
Yeah, and are you keeping up her legacy by reading and writing about the past? I mean, did you think of yourself that way when you begin?
I have thought of that before.
you know, writing about the past person.
Yes, definitely. And I my first original idea, as I said earlier, about just doing something with her memoir, either doing a historical background for it or even just annotating, it was all about wanting to finish that for her, to have a finished product, which I knew she would have wanted. But it became much more than that with this book, and I still like to think she would have approved. I'm certain she would.
I'm sure she would approve, and I definitely approve and recommend this for a lot of reasons. I assume it's on Amazon and everywhere.
Oh yes.
Oh yes. All right. Victoria Bynum, thank you so much for coming in and talking to me.
Thank you again for the invitation. I really enjoyed it.
All right. And as always, thank you for listening.